If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome along to a brand new episode of Writer's Routine. This week we're chatting to Eva Rice. She's back with a brand new novel after a few years away. It's called This Could Be Everything. We talk about why she likes noise and atmosphere when she's working. Also why Adrian Mole can always pick her out of a slump. And you can hear how her energy ebbs and flows while she's writing.
I find it to be a constant wrestle and a constant battle with yourself. And a friend of mine once said, every time he opens a laptop, he says out loud, "Congratulations," because that's almost the hardest bit of the whole thing, is starting it and congratulating yourself on that. I can get, as everyone can, really, you get quite despondent if you feel at the beginning of the day that you set off feeling, oh, this is going to be a great day's work, and then half an hour in you're thinking, why can't I do this? And it is, for me, it is normally a case of just plow on and just hope for the best. Just keep going. It doesn't matter if you're writing absolute garbage. Just get through it.
There is more with Eva Rice in this week's Writer's Routine. Yes, welcome along to the show. My name's Dan Simpson and this is Writer's Routine. It's the podcast where we take a look through an author's working day to see how they get stuff done, how they get that idea and then plan their entire day, their work, their life, their space to give them the best chance of getting it down onto the page. And this week, our episode is brought to you by Plotter. I'm very excited for a little while. Plotter are helping to power this show just like they can power your writing. Plotter is a writing tool. It's a software that does what the title says, really. It plots. It helps you plan your books the way that you think. It helps you outline faster, smarter, and it gives you a chance to turbocharge your productivity. Now, some of those can be buzzwords, but you instantly see how Plotter can help you out. When you open the software, you get a digital corkboard where you can easily map everything. And it's really intuitive with the way that it helps you do that. You can easily swap between your timeline, the outline, your notes, the details of your characters and the places. You can even tag it all to make it easier to skim through what you need to find it instantly. And if you're a visual writer, all of it's color-coded as well, as it might be in a notebook. So if you like to see everything in front of you, everything that's going on in however way that you want, in the simplest possible way, well, Plotter can help you do that. It's perfect for it. It allows you to track the details of your plot at a scene level and switch, swap, and then use them as you want. And what I really like about it, if you're having trouble getting an idea into a manageable plot, if you've got that kernel, you just can't figure out where the journey might take your hero, thinking about where it can go. It's got more than 30 proven plot templates from some of the best writers around on their website to kickstart your story planning, to give you some ideas to snap it into life. And we've spoken on the show many times about different types of writing software. Maybe you use some of them. And this works with them all. You don't need to worry about it being something extra that you've got to get that really has no bearing on what you've worked on before. You can import and export on this from Word and Scrivener to seamlessly transfer your story into some tech that helps you flesh out further and actually write the thing. It helps you spend more time writing. and less time worrying about everything else. For so many of us writers, we spend so much time faffing about the window dressing of simply getting ideas and words onto a page, and Plotter really helps with that. It helps you strip back to see what is important and what you need to focus on. Now, the best way for you to look around and for you to see how useful it can be and how simple the software is and how stunning it looks really is by getting to plotter.com and taking a look around. That's Plotter, plotter.com, by the way. And while you're there, if you use the link that is in the episode notes, you get 10% off the software with this show, which means that for under £20, $22.50, about 18 quid, you get access to this software forever, which helps you plan and plot your story, and it can make you organise smarter and outline faster. It really does, I'll say it again, turbocharge your productivity. To get that deal, use the code that is in the episode notes of this show. It's go.plotter, without the E, P-L-O-T-T-R, go.plotter.com/routine, and you can get 10% off this fantastic software, which helps you plan and plot your software in a much simpler way. Let's get to it then with Eva Rice. She's written 5 novels, including The Lost Art of Keeping Secrets, which was huge in the mid-noughties. You might remember it. It was a runner-up in the Richard and Judy Book Prize of the Year in 2006. Her new one is This Could Be Everything. It's all about February, who has lost hope, is rudderless, and the yellow bird that flies into her life one downtrodden morning and offers her a glimmer of hope. We talk about how frustrating it is writing words that you know will be cut, why she doesn't like the first bits of plotting, how the characters decided how long they would stick around for, and because the book is set in the 90s, we have a little reminisce about the 90s and what made them very specifically the 90s. Aside from that, there is a lot of brilliant chat about planning, about when you start your day, about how she works around everything else that goes on into her life. There's a lot going on, and I think there's tons for you to take away from it. So let's jump into it with Eva Rice, and we start as we always do with what she sees around her in the place where she sits down to write.
I'm one of those annoying writers who doesn't stick hugely to one particular place, but I'd like to work in the kitchen when I can. So what I see around me is normally some Weetabix drying on the inside of a cereal bowl that my son has left after breakfast, something like that. And the dog, I like having him in eye line, just because I don't like being on my own to work particularly. So I like feeling there's another living creature in the room. I have other books around me, but not really ones that I want to dip into, more ones with the titles just to kind of frighten me into remembering how great they are.
Like what? Examples of which?
At the moment I have Brideshead Revisited, which I got out. I mean, it's a great book, but I happened to get it out the other day, and then I did that thing of opening it up and reading one page and thinking, well, why do I bother? And then just putting it down again. And I always have The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole.
Okay.
Because it's, well, A, because it's a work of genius, and B, because you can just pick it up and give yourself half a page in the middle of something difficult, and it, first of all, makes you feel much lighter and happier, and secondly, is just like just that kind of injection of her brilliance is... I've always had that one on my desk. Always.
I need to reread that. I've not read it since I was probably the age of Adrian Mole, so 13 and three quarters or whatever he is. I'd be interested to see. I've always wondered how well it translates to being an adult. Like, is it too on the nose? Some of the gags on there, but
no, I think the brilliant thing about it is that it does work when you're 13, and then it works in a completely different way when you're an adult, and also especially now because it's such a period piece. It's so of its time, and there's just brilliant one-liners, like, you know, on Easter Sunday, or poor Jesus, I wouldn't have had the guts to do it myself. I mean, just like. So good, so funny, and so I like to have him on standby on my desk, so that's always there. Yeah.
So you've got the books, you've got food detritus around you.
Yes, which is just that's sheer laziness of not clearing up after breakfast. Yeah,
that's fine. What is there that it kind of keeps you working? Is there anything practical around you? So post-it notes, perhaps, or a big whiteboard, notebook, something that lets you know what you're doing.
I've tried with that. In the past, and I find I find going off track from those things really annoys me. And so my easiest way is just don't have it in the first place. I do have a notebook because I like the physical act of handwriting. So I have my pot of pens as well. Even though I don't write nearly as much as I used to, as everyone finds when they suddenly have to write a letter, you know, your muscles in your hand are completely unused in the way that when you were writing, you know, A-level answers, you could just zip through. And, you know, your hand was totally fine at the end. And now it's just a different experience writing. But I do try and have something to write ideas down with, yeah.
What is there that's inspirational around you? So we've got the books. Is there pictures, paintings, maybe framed covers from previous books to let you know that, hey, you can do this, you've done this before?
Yeah, I have a copy of Lost Art of Keeping Secrets in a couple of different languages on the desk to make me think, ooh, you know, that was good. That made it into a few other languages, which is always exciting. And then inspiration wise, I've always got something music related on the desk. So I've got a picture of Michael J. Fox framed from Back to the Future playing the guitar.
The classic.
I mean, why wouldn't you have that? Yeah.
What's on the desk? As in, practically, what are you writing with? We get quite niche and nerdy. People are very interested in the peculiarities.
Did I hear someone with you talking about font in heavy detail?
Yeah, you would have heard that.
Yeah, I love that.
Are you concerned about your font?
No, but I think I'm in a really weird camp of quite liking Times New Roman. Is that quite strange?
I don't think it's strange at all.
Really?
Because I
still feel like people have been slightly raging against it recently. Maybe that's just my friends.
No, perhaps, but they might not be in the world of publishing.
Yes.
Whereas, I think, do you need to submit in Times New Roman or Arial or something?
Yes, in Times New Roman. So I normally write in that anyway. But also, there's something about it that somehow elevates whatever you're writing and makes it seem a little bit better than it actually is. Whereas I think other fonts can do the opposite of that. Yeah, that's my personal opinion on that.
And it makes sense. If you are, you know, if you have to submit in a certain font, why would you waste your time faffing around with it?
Yeah, but I think lots of people do. I think people like that kind of Wizard of Oz, everything going to colour moment of just highlighting everything and then putting it into a different font, maybe at the end of the day, putting it into the correct one, and sort of seeing how the page lines up differently and how many words fit on the page. And that, I mean, word count is just, you know, the constant worry, I suppose, that's just always haunting you.
That's a really good way of describing it, the Wizard of Oz moment. The first time it had really been made aware to me of how important fonts could be, I was chatting to an author, the comic Mark Watson, who publishes a few books. Yeah, and he flagged up that he would edit in a different font because it would help him notice things
that's
missed.
That's a very good idea. That's a very good idea. Yeah. Why didn't I think of that?
Perhaps not font-wise, then. Have you picked up any tricks along the way that you use just to make you see the page differently, perhaps to make you think about what you're writing in a different manner?
I do. I have, probably fairly basic stuff, like I use italics quite a lot in new sections, but also because there's something a bit kind of sort of otherworldly D.H. Lawrence-ish about it, I think. Just using lots of, don't know why it feels like putting something into a kind of more dramatic style, and then you know that that's something new that you've done that day, and you then got to go back and obliterate it again. But yeah, I feel as though Mark's tip is a really good one, actually. I should be doing that, using a different font to edit.
Yeah, I think it has helped people.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not
really
a show.
It's really logical. I mean, that feels like the sort of thing you should do. But then maybe you grow not to like your editing font because you know.
I think he mixes it up.
Yeah. So he chooses something completely different every time.
I think so. That was the vibe I got.
Yes.
But I mean, if that's helpful to you, by all means. The point of this show is not to give you advice. It's to get advice from you.
I'm taking all the advice I can get.
Well, you're more than welcome.
Well, on a day that I'm writing and working, I'm still doing things like delivering children to school. So I kind of have to get that bit done, which, you know, that's normally a bit of a marathon, as it is for anyone with kids. And also, you know, this it's the constant thing of, if you're working from home, not letting the distractions get you. It's like kind of Super Mario Land. Can you just sort of avoid them? And that's always difficult. I prefer, if I got into, well, it's different. This book that I've just fit, well, this book that's coming out was written entirely, really, in lockdown. So that felt quite different routine-wise to my other books. But I like to be in a space with noise, which is maybe a little bit weird. I'm not talking about, you know, a rave, but I like to go somewhere where there's a feeling of other life, hence sometimes writing with the dog in the room just to feel like there's another breathing entity.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's probably, maybe it's just to do with, you know, general lack of excitement about my own company, perhaps. I don't know. Just,
When you were growing up, was there a constant noise of collaboration around you?
Yes, I think maybe that's something to do with it. Maybe just feeling like there were a lot of people maybe in the house or coming in and out of rooms, and so I didn't. I like, who is it, that brilliant, is it Antonia Fraser, who said her idea of heaven is to be alone in a house full of people. So, you know, so it's like some great line like that, which I totally get, but I feel as though if there aren't other people in the house, I'll take myself out. And I do have membership to the London Library, which is a complete dream. And just you walk in, and the second you walk in, you feel like you're working, even if you don't do anything, just because you're there. My brother always says that it's some full of sexual tension, which is an interesting one. Yeah. That the library, I don't know why. I haven't totally felt that myself, but, you know, it's always time. Reason to keep going back. And there's always sort of somebody asleep in an armchair reading the paper. And it's very, you feel you're going back in time slightly when you're there, but in the best way. It's just such an amazing building. And so if I go there, I'll stay there for a couple of hours and then have a wander around Piccadilly and wander back in again after 40 minutes or so. I don't like to do huge long stretches without breaks. So I like to get up, stand up, walk around the room. And often I need the time in the day just to walk and think about the plot. So, and sometimes the car is actually a really good place to do that. If I'm ever driving a child somewhere or something, I can do that. But it's all making me sound like incredibly middle class bourgeois, this whole routine. But the London Library, if I'm not there, I will go to a cafe, I'll go anywhere nearby just to be with other people. And I don't really mind, there's quite a high level of noise I can tolerate, that I can block out and work with, which other people find a little bit odd, maybe. But I just prefer it. On the other hand, I don't like music when I work, because I find that too distracting. It's a bit like, I can't do music when people are eating. It's my worst thing. Sorry to all my friends who might have done this if they're listening. But when you go to someone's house and then, you know, you're having some food or something and someone puts on, so I just can't do it. I can't, because I feel like the music requires sort of attention somehow.
Yeah, I get that.
Does that make me sound like a real weirdo? I just can't kind of seem to take my one ear away from whatever the music is.
But any music, though?
Backgroundy stuff, obviously not so much, but if they're playing, you know, if I go and, I went somewhere the other day to try and do a bit of work, and they were playing, it felt like it was almost the whole of the Madonna Ray of Light album. And then I was just, well, I'm not going to be able to work now, that's fine, I just can't work. If it's something that I like, I can't really have that on in the background. So I prefer to have a kind of babble of noise of people talking or ordering a coffee or something like that. In the London Library, obviously, it's quiet, but there's just a sense of a lot of activity.
What time would you normally start a stint at the London Library if you're there?
Realistically, probably not until about 10, something like that.
And how long will you carry it on for?
I would probably do, say, until 12 and then have a break and then come back at, say, 12:45 and then do another 2 hours, something like that. That's about my limit. But I do sometimes, at the end of the day, when everyone's asleep, I sometimes have spurts of writing quite late. But I can only really do that if I know I've got to get up early, haven't got to get up early the next morning.
So those little windows of time that you've given yourself, say 10 till 12, quarter to 1 till 2, 2-3 o'clock, something like that. How do you find your energy and your concentration ebbing and flowing through that time?
I find it to be a constant wrestle and a constant battle with yourself. And a friend of mine once said, every time he opens a laptop, he says out loud, "Congratulations," because that's almost the hardest bit of the whole thing, is starting it and congratulating yourself on that. I can get, as everyone can, really, you get quite despondent if you feel at the beginning of the day that you set off feeling, oh, this is going to be a great day's work, and then half an hour in you're thinking, why can't I do this? And it is, for me, it is normally a case of just plow on and just hope for the best. Just keep going. It doesn't matter if you're writing absolute garbage, just get through it, and then go back and do it again. It's really hard, isn't it, being a writer?
Extraordinarily hard. And what always amazes me, and I want to pick your brains about this, is I've spoken to authors who have published hundreds of books, and which book is this? How many is this? Your fifth or sixth? Sixth book. So you know you can do it. Mm-hmm. You know that you are able to crack out 80,000-90,000 words. You know that you're able to get that done, and you know how you work best. Why do you think there is still the struggle of, can I do it today? Why can't I do it today? Why is opening the laptop, as your friend said, such a struggle today?
It's probably to do with just... because I think particularly with fiction, maybe, there's the pressure on yourself of it being... of it all coming from your own head, your own imagination. You can't, rely on the fact that you're using other people's work or facts or anything. And so it feels so unbelievably heavy on you sometimes, and it feels quite, you can't help but take it personally against yourself if you're not quite getting it right. And I think that the way that I work best, the reason why I would then maybe in the afternoon walk from London Library to Notting Hill, is to process what I've attempted to do, and I honestly talk out loud to myself in the car. I have to listen to what I've attempted. So, in this book I'd be going, yeah, but if Theo was there on that night, then would he come back the next night? And then I'll sort of almost answer myself. I'm making myself sound literally insane, but I feel like sometimes if I don't talk it out, I can't get to that point. Sometimes I have days where I don't work for very long because I suddenly know what I'm going to do with the plot. And it's like, the relief is so huge. That's the difficult bit for me, not necessarily the writing, the plotting and the structure.
Have you learned anything along the way that helps that out at all, that helps that struggle? I know it can't be music because you don't enjoy writing with music. You mentioned the walk.
Yeah.
Some people will enjoy a cup of coffee at a certain time. What do you do?
Yeah, I think, walking and weirdly and very... unenvironmentally friendly wise, the car I do find quite useful because you're kind of, you can talk out loud and you can kind of try and digest what it is you're trying to do. And sometimes you get a feeling of total triumph at the end of that because you know that, okay, I've got it now, I know what I'm trying to do. And then the execution of it isn't really the worst part for me. It's the plotting and the structure. And I think it was G.K. Chesterton, all the best quotes are his, aren't they? Who said something like, when writing, start as close to the end as you can, which is just probably a very well-known thing. But I remember reading that before I started this one and thinking, because I was going to have a lot more about the central character's life before she gets to the point where it does start. And I ended up just cutting all of that. But even the act of cutting is satisfying and is fine if you know what you're doing.
Is it not frustrating for you now to feel like you're writing words which are going to be cut?
Yes, it can be, but it's so much part of the process that it never feels sort of worthless. And sometimes you might just take one sentence and one idea from something that's 2,000 words long and still use that, and then think that block of time was worth it for that one little bit.
What do you do about the doubt that plays through your mind when you are writing? I mean, we mentioned how tough it is sometimes to carry on. What do you do about the doubt of is this good enough? Someone, I got an email from a listener recently who wanted, I think was writing a debut and was just struggling with that worry. Is this worth it? Is this good enough?
I mean, I don't think that you're ever going to think, well, I personally don't imagine that I'd ever think I'd written the perfect novel, because I think that's a really hard thing to feel about your own work. Of course, you can feel about other people's. So once you've accepted that, it's going to be perfectly imperfect, then, or imperfectly perfect, then that's, you've just got to take the pressure off yourself. And also know that it happens to absolutely everyone. No one is sitting down and going, well, off I go for my perfect, you know, 1,500 words today, and I'm sure there won't be any issues, and I'm sure I'll keep every single word of this. So you just have to kind of remember that everyone feels the same in that sense.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thank you so much to Plotter for sponsoring the show today. If you'd like to get 10% off their fantastic software to help you plot and plan your work much simpler, head to go.plotter, without the E, P-L-O-T-T-R, go.plotter.com/routine. Now, if you enjoy the podcast, if we have helped the way that you work with all these fantastic authors that we bring you more or less every week, you can help that carry on by backing and pledging to support the show at patreon.com/writersroutine. I know there's a lot of links, so you'll have to bear with me for that. But on our Patreon page, you get access to conversations that we're having quite a lot, little ideas floating around the writing community there about books that we've read, about ways that you get to work, even about the fonts that you like too. Also, for just a small contribution every month, it really isn't a lot, but I know times are tight, so anything that you can give goes an extraordinarily long way. You get merch, there is bonus content, there is even a way for your book to sponsor this show. So if you've published recently, maybe you've self-published, whatever it is, if you think that your book deserves more noise than it's got, I know it can be really tough being a debut writer at times, then let me do that plugging for you. To make that happen, to help this show keep going and keep bringing you chats with fantastic authors, the most successful around, as often as we can, support the show. A little goes an extraordinarily long way. I'm really appreciative for everything that you can send over as a pledge by becoming a backer at patreon.com/writersroutine. Let's get back to it with Eva Rice then, chatting about her new novel, This Could Be Everything. We'll hear a lot more about the novel in this half. We talk about why she doesn't like that first bit of plotting, how the characters themselves decided how long they would stick around. And we've chatted about what she does when the going is a bit tough. What about the flip side? What does she do to carry on when the going is brilliant?
I have this expression which is quite useful. which is all-terrain writing. So you just, wherever you are, I think there was one time when the car had a blowout on the motorway or something, and I was just scrambling up the bank with a couple of kids in tow. And I remember thinking, oh God, I'm now going to lose half an hour, and just doing like 10 minutes waiting for the AA guy to get there. And I think you sometimes have to have that mentality that you're not always going to be sitting down at your preferred desk with, you know, no distractions and everything's all lined up perfectly to make it work. Sometimes the best stuff you'll do will be when you're really not expecting it. And when that does happen, when you get those bits where you think, oh, that really works, then it's good to kind of keep going, because it will then stop.
It's amazing, isn't it, how this is something that so many people have done, published a book.
Yeah.
So many people have sat down and tried to write a book, yet no one's quite figured out the rules of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it feels like there should be a more, an easier code, or a kind of more generic way of approaching it. But actually, I think the whole thing of all-terrain writing is, the other reason why that's quite a good one is that you then remember where you were when you wrote certain bits. So you think, oh, that was the bit I wrote when, you know, I was kind of waiting in the train station, it was on my lap waiting for the next train. And then somehow that kind of, it gives the book something more likable, maybe, for you when you're working on it. Because sometimes it's really hard to like your own work when it's in transit, sort of thing. You like bits of it, but there are other bits that you're thinking, oh, I know I'm going to change this, but for the moment it's in there and I just have to put up with it.
When you're in the London Library, mm-hmm. is there an aim for that day? Is it just time that you're leaving? Do you think, right, I'm going to crack out 500, 1,000 words, then be done with it?
I try to do a bit of a word count challenge, because just because it's a very simple way of seeing how much you've done. But obviously, they might not be a great 1,000 words, but at least you feel like you've achieved that. I sometimes will do 2,000. I kind of always aim for between 1,000 and 2,000.
And are you trying to work every day?
Trying to, yes. Yes, definitely trying to. Always try to. Because that's the other thing, is that it's incredible how easy it is for ideas and a flow to be interrupted by a day of not doing anything. I mean, that's one of the big problems if you do leave it, and you just have to go back and reread everything and get it back into the mindset, and then it just delays it.
So this story, this could be everything. This is your sixth. When was the fifth published?
The fifth came out in 2015 in hardback, so it's been a long time.
I speak to a lot of authors doing the show.
Yeah.
I've spoken to authors who have published three books a year.
I know.
How do you find this, I guess, luxury you have, this liberty of being able to have 8 years between publications?
There was quite a big difference between the last book I wrote and this book. I did actually write another one between, which I abandoned. Not abandoned. I quite liked it, but I felt I got to the end of it and I thought, no, this is not the book I want to do at this point in history. But I did finish it. So in my head, even though there's been a big gap, there has been one in the middle of that.
Is that not annoying? I mean, hopefully that'll come out.
Very annoying.
But for you, who earns money publishing books,
yeah.
does it not feel a massive waste of time?
Yeah, yes. I was pretty frustrated with myself when I realised that that one wasn't the one I wanted to do. But then I guess that makes this one feel like it is more what I want to be doing. And I have been doing other stuff in between that's also been writing related, like working on the script for Lost Art of Keeping Secrets and other stuff, you know, all writing, but just not the book, as in not the novel.
We will talk about This Could Be Everything in just a second, and I don't want to harp on about a novel that isn't going to see the light of day, but I'm just curious, what was it about that book that didn't feel right about that time?
I mean, it just felt as though it didn't feel as though I completely believed in it as a story and as characters and I kept on thinking when I was writing it, it's going to get to a point where it's suddenly going to fall into place and I'm suddenly going to like it. But I never really got to that point. So when I had the idea for this one, I was still kind of thinking about keeping the old one going, but I kind of put it down to do this one. And then once I started on this one, I thought, ah, this is what I was meant to be doing, I guess. Well, it was based on a real life experience, I guess, of mine, in that I found a canary in my kitchen. That was in 2000, and this book set in 1990. But I always thought when that happened that it felt like something out of a book, because it was a high up flat, and this canary had come through the window and was sitting in the kitchen eating salad from a bowl, and I kept it and put up notices and no one claimed it. And I then went on to to buy him a friend because he was singing constantly. And then they bred baby canaries, and it was just a big canary time for me. and so I always thought that was something I wanted to bring into a story somehow. But the idea of it being set in 1990 was very much me thinking at the beginning of lockdown, what's a time that would be really fun to write about at this quite unfun time in history.
Why did 1990 ring those bells?
Because I was actually slightly younger than my character in 1990, but I wanted to write about a girl in her late teens at that particular point in history, because it was kind of pre-Britpop, pre-Blair, coming out of the 80s, slightly unexplored, weirdly, as a time. The kind of early 90s, I always feel, it's like people think of the 90s as, you know, Cool Britannia and Britpop and that kind of thing, in a very kind of obvious way. And actually, all the fiction I've done, or that certainly the last three books, I've used the point in history before something big takes off. So in Lost Art of Keeping Secrets, it was set in 1954, which was just before Elvis, just, you know, quite a long time before the Beatles. It was a kind of pre-rock and roll, but there was a feeling of uprising in the same way that there was in the next book I wrote, which was set in the early 60s, pre-Beatles, pre-Stones, pre, you know, everything you'd associate with the 60s. Yeah. Because I find that kind of pre-massive cultural shift bit almost as interesting, if not more interesting, as the actual bit when it was really happening.
It's kind of, I always think it's kind of like you're putting the ingredients into a pot before you turn the oven on.
Yes.
It's everything else that's happening. You're watching all the little fires that are started before that one big catalyst could be Elvis or the Beatles or... I was born in 1991.
Yeah, okay.
So I'm not going to say it was me, that I was the catalyst. Yeah, yeah. What was the 90s catalyst? So Britpop was slightly later, so 94, 95.
Yeah.
From your memory, what was the moment that kind of kicked it all off during the 90s?
In the 90s in general?
Yeah, what was the sudden spark that made it suddenly not Thatcher of the 80s? What suddenly changed everything from your memory?
I was also in my sort of early teens at that sort of late 80s, early 90s time. But I remember making compilation tapes at the end of the 80s where I kind of listed everything that happened news-wise in the 80s, you know, everything from kind of, I don't know, sort of what was number one at the time through to the fall of the Berlin Wall, you know, on a kind of little thing to go with it. And it feels as though the 90s kind of, it's almost like it takes a bit of time to get going. So, but it kind of propelled, it was the decade that propelled us into, the new century. So I guess at the beginning of the decade, I'm trying to think of what would have been the thing that I associated with kickstarting the 90s. Do you mean sort of music-wise?
Well, I don't really know. I guess I'm just trying to put my finger on it, to turn it over in my head. I've got an idea that decades are usually defined by the later years.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Everyone kind of forgets about the early ones. Yeah. They see it as a hangover from the 80s, what would have been before. Yeah. And thankfully, we're in 2023 now, and it doesn't feel like we know what this decade is at all at the moment.
No, that's true. I think that's... And I just remember at the beginning of 1990 feeling everywhere there was a sense of, oh, this is the last decade of, you know... And that felt quite real and quite... It felt very space agey. Just the decade being the 90s, yeah, just felt like that at the time. But what I did with this book, which was quite surreal in a way for me was I actually found online the top 40 countdowns of the weeks that I was writing about. So I was listening to that happening almost in real time, because you can find them as they happened. So you could listen to that kind of, you know, an up three places at number 37 or whatever, and you actually feel like you're still there. You're like, oh yeah, God, I wonder what's going to be number one, when you actually know what it is. So that was really interesting musically, because everything was so, there was a real range of weird stuff in the charts in the early 90s and coming out of the 80s, and going, you got kind of hints of Britpop with sort of the Happy Mondays and the Charlatans and stuff, but it was kind of, and then obviously there was a huge blanket of Stock Aitken and Waterman produced records, and kind of, it was like a sort of weird drinks party with kind of the most random people you could ever imagine all invited together, kind of. Just when you listen to those countdowns of the top 40, and you just think, God, this is, it's like, it was like the years, the kind of decades trying to sort itself out, and it didn't quite know what direction it was going to go in.
So you've got this huge idea. Well, it's at this point, you have the idea of the canary, the bird, because this has gone into your flat, and you know you want to, it would be fun to write about the 1990.
Yeah.
It's quite a big catch-all there. It's quite a big idea for you to play with. What happens next for you? It is as simple as, what do you do? You mentioned right at the start that you don't always love the planning and the plotting, because it's something to distract yourself with almost, or not to pay attention to. What happened next after you had that initial idea of something that happened in your life and a time frame?
I wanted to make sure that I gave the character some very difficult things to deal with, because I felt as though then it can go, you know, it can only get better for her from there. So I did that, and then, as I said, I tried doing something which was, there was a lot more explanation to it, and there was a lot more detail on that. And then I ended up thinking, no, we've got to start it with, you're just going to get right into it in that first chapter of what's happened to her and what's happened to her family, because then you're getting the kind of immediacy of the situation that she's in. And so I wrote the first chapter not really knowing where it was going to go at all, which I didn't end up keeping, but the first idea I just wrote thinking, where's this going to take me, and narrowing it down to a certain bit of London was quite useful, and I kind of thought, well, I'm writing about 1990, which, you know, is a decade that I've, the 90s of a decade I lived through, but I want to make sure that I'm getting things right as well, because there's just so much that you kind of, there's a lot that when you write, and even in the quite near past, recent past, that you then go, oh God, actually, did they have that then, or had that book been published then? So you then have to kind of keep really alert to all that stuff, which is quite hard, but I like that.
Where did the plot come from? Because you have this initial idea, as I said, of girl, this is February,
yes,
who finds this bird in her home. And then we find out a lot more, and she's been through a pretty terrible time. Mm-hmm. Where does that idea come from? How are you driving the plot forward? It can't just simply be as easy as chucking a lot of bad stuff her way. Like, there needs to be a plot that she's being pushed through.
Yeah.
How are you asking yourself? Well, I guess, what questions are you asking yourself
to get the plot started?
Yeah. Like, what's the thread that's driving this thing, and how are you
coming to that? I think what it is, or what it was, was coming out of darkness in a slightly eccentric way, perhaps. Like, with this bird, it's the last thing she expects to see, and also the last thing that she wants to pay any attention to. And she's frightened of it, because she doesn't understand. She's reading all kinds of weird symbolism into it. And why is it here? And I just want it to go away. And then, so the bird kind of symbolises a lot of stuff right from the very beginning. But once I'd got this idea that the bird had to come from somewhere, where's it come from, who does it belong to, how is she going to find out who it belongs to, and how is that going to affect her, then everything became much easier. And also putting her in a house with her, living with her aunt and uncle, and having this parallel plot that was going on with her aunt having this affair with a colleague, and somehow how that tied in with her. I knew I wanted these two plots kind of running at the same time, and they're both in the way about massive change and how you deal with that. And the bird is the kind of, I don't know, I guess the sort of feathered version of this.
You said that you don't like the initial plotting that much. How much did you know about the story before you sat down to write it?
I think I knew enough to get going, because with me it's almost like I just have to stoke the fire enough to get the fire going, and then it'll be all right. And sometimes actually I write ideas for plots that I kind of think, well, this won't happen, but I'll write it down anyway, because you never know where you're going to be taken by a character, and you never know what they're going to do to sort of barge their way back in when you think you've got rid of them. I don't think I thought that there's a character called Gregory Arrowsmith, who's the guy who the aunt, her aunt Anne is having this affair with, and I kind of imagined he was just going to pop in and you'd just see him for a short time, and I just found him so fun. Then I was like, oh, I've done now three chapters with him. And then you kind of have to pull it back a bit. But by that point, you really like him. And or even, you know, do you like him? Do you not like him? He just becomes something that you want to keep in. Yeah, that's what happens a lot with me.
The tone's incredibly conversational.
Yes.
And it's full of personality. And as soon as you start reading it, you feel like you know February quite a lot. Mm. How are you making that work? How are you... You know, this is a story that partially happened to you, inspired by something that happened to you.
Yeah.
So it could be easy for it to become far more autobiographical, wow, than perhaps it was. How are you getting to know her voice to such an extent that it's different to yours?
Well, because she's Texan, she's that was a good grounding for me in knowing that she'd had this background of her father was a Texan guy, and she'd grown up for a bit of her childhood there, and that kind of felt like she had a bit, I could sort of hear her voice and her kind of the struggle of wanting desperately to say she's from London but kind of feeling like she's American, and who she was from that point of view. But also I think, I don't know, I mean, the conversational style is something I just like to write in that style, so I found that really fun for her as well, just to have this sense of she's literally splurging out a lot of stuff. And actually at the time my partner boyfriend was writing and has been writing an adaptation of a David Peace book, Red or Dead, and I had this whole kind of weird sort of parallel inspiration coming from David Peace in my head, because every time I picked up Red or Dead I would read his sort of slight, that is very kind of repetitive. I don't know if you read that book. It's about Bill Shankly, yeah. So you get these repeated sentences and these this very sort of almost liturgical style. And so I felt like there was a bit of that seeping into her voice, but then at the same time there was a kind of frantic panic attack vibe to it as well. It's sort of almost like I said the other day, it's like sort of Betty Boo and David Peace had a baby. This weird mashup of kind of high drama and sort of panic and repeated sentences and repeated questioning. Once you have a style and once the character has a voice, it flows a lot quicker, obviously. So it was getting her voice, and then once I had that, and also the text and expressions, that was really fun, because I do actually have. I've been to Texas, and I've got, oddly enough, I've got family connections in Texas, but I wanted to get all of the kind of the Texan bits that she hasn't got rid of in there. So every so often there'll be just a very, very, very Texan line from her. And that was also quite a good grounding thing for me to understand who she was.
Last question, and this is nothing about your new book. I'm aware that a lot of people listening to the show maybe haven't published a book yet. So I'd like to ask you, with the space that you've had, 7 years between this book and your last one, what's it like? And I'm also aware that I've spoken to a lot of people who, as I said, publish so many books a year that maybe they don't get the chance to sit down and appreciate what they've done.
Yeah.
What's it like to have published a book? How open and vague is that? Do you still, when you've put a book out there, do you still enjoy the fact that you have done that?
Oh yeah, I think you have to enjoy the fact that it's out there. You have to think, you have to give yourself a pat on the back and think that's great. I still find it quite a lonely thing to do in terms of the fact that you're not sharing the writing, obviously. But it feels like it's there's something still quite not invasive, but it still feels like you're opening yourself up in a big way, and I still find that quite hard, but also a thrill. It has to be a thrill. Otherwise, you know, never do the next one.
That is it for Eva Rice. Thank you so much to Eva for coming on the show. That new novel is This Could Be Everything, and it's out right now. Next week, we're chatting to Abdulrazak Gurnah, who won the 2021 Nobel Prize for Literature. You might remember at the back end of last year, I tried to get this interview out, but it didn't quite work. The audio wasn't brilliant for us. Can't be bothered to get into the details. But basically, I think I fixed it. So that should be out next week. Fingers crossed. If not, I've got loads more other authors that can't wait to tell you the story of how they get their story down. But all being well, it will be with Abdulrazak Gurnah next week on the show. Remember, we are sponsored by Plotter, a brilliant writing software that helps you plot and plan very simply. You can get 10% off their software for less than £20. I think it's $22.50. To get that discount, head to go.plotter.com/routine. It's without the E, go.plotter.com/routine. You can use the link as well that's in the episode notes wherever you're listening. You can support us on Patreon as well at patreon.com/writersroutine. And I will see you next week with Abdulrazak Gurnah on the show.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.